We will begin today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 573. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Present ORS 811.028 creates a Class B traffic violation for drivers who fail to stop and remain stopped for pedestrian. The offense covers failing to stop and remain stopped for pedestrians who, the first element, is a pedestrian that is proceeding in accordance with a traffic control device or is crossing a roadway in a crosswalk, and then the second element details that the pedestrian is in particular locations, including either the lane that the driver is in, a lane adjacent to the lane the driver's in, the lane into which the driver is turning, a lane adjacent to the lane into which the driver is turning, or a location less than 6 feet from the lane into which the driver is turning. What Senate Bill 573 does is it adds a third option to element one. That is, if the pedestrian is, quote, preparing to enter a crosswalk, unquote. It then also specifies that a pedestrian raising a hand and arm toward oncoming traffic is considered to be entering a lane.
Okay, Council, that's all a fancy way of saying that if you give a signal, you don't have to step into the crosswalk and risk your life to exercise your rights to cross the street. You simply have to signal from the sidewalk and the traffic has to stop. Is that correct, Council?
That is the English translation.
Okay, appreciate it. Uh-huh. All right, I'm stalling for time, as you might guess. Scott Bricker, Ray Thomas, and Jerry Zolotta. I assume you all wanted to come up together.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Bricker. I'm the policy director for the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and also advocate and representative for the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. With me, I have two other folks to testify, Ray Thomas, who is an advocate, a lawyer, and someone who's been working on bicycle and pedestrian law for a long time, and Jerry Zolotta, who's a member of the Oregon Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee, and a small business owner. Just for a little bit of background, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition are nonprofit organizations, and we advocate for safe bicycling, safe walking. We've been working on these issues for over 15 years. Safety, traffic safety, is one of the biggest reasons why people don't bicycle and why pedestrian people are walking less. In fact, there are certain trends. For example, in the 1970s, over 50% of children biked and walked to school, and within a mile, almost 90% did. Just within one generation, that number has fallen to 10%. Again, traffic hazards are one of the major reasons cited for that. There are a variety of other issues. Traffic fatalities are the top cause of death and major injury for ages 1 through 34, and a top cause for children ages 5 through 9, pedestrian-related crashes specifically. In the last couple of legislative sessions, we've been very excited and supportive of the strong pedestrian-related laws that have been enacted, and today we bring to you in addition to that, something that is very innovative and we hope we can get your support on, which would effectively create a hand signal for pedestrians. Automobile users have signals. Well, they used to be hand signals. They're now blinkers, I guess, as we call them. Bicyclists are required to use signals, but pedestrians have no way to express their intentions on the roadway. The bill that we're bringing forward to you today that my colleagues will discuss a little bit further would actually create a signal for pedestrians to be able to express their intention to enter a crosswalk when preparing to enter into a crosswalk or when in the street, and this would be something that would increase interaction between vehicle drivers, bicyclists, and pedestrians, but would also have a legal requirement. So with that, I'd like to pass it over to Ray Thomas. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And appreciate having a chance to speak with you. I'm a member of the legislative committee. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. And
can you give your name for the record?
Yes, I'm Ray Thomas, and 820 Southwest 2nd Avenue, Portland, Oregon, Suite 200, 97204. And we created for the committee and staff a handout that I think folks may have. The second page contains kind of a nice photographic presentation of both the need for and the effect of the proposed change in the law. And first of all, let me say that the current Oregon law requires that a pedestrian, in order to exercise their right-of-way, actually step out into the zone of danger. And it's difficult for us who are in the safety community to give children and other folks a good formula for how to safely encounter and cross crosswalks, because the way that they trigger the right-of-way is to actually place their bodies in the path of the vehicles. And what we want to do is to improve the law so that when a person wants to enter into a crosswalk and trigger their right-of-way as a pedestrian, there can be some signals so that without actually placing themselves in the zone of danger, they can determine whether, in fact, this motorist sees them. Now, in the safety community, oftentimes we teach both for bicyclists and pedestrians to try to make eye contact. But you cannot trust eye contact alone, because many times people will look at you and they have you completely tuned out. However, if we change the law so that the right-of-way is triggered by the raising of the hand and the position in as the person is preparing to enter, the child or the pedestrian can see whether or not the motorist is honoring their right-of-way. And the nice thing about this is that one of the frustrations that law enforcement has had in enforcing the old law is that it's difficult to really tell whether the pedestrian is actually intending to enter the lane and exercise their right-of-way. That's why they have to do these stings. Because what happens under the present law is that unless the person actually steps into the danger zone, they don't really trigger the right-of-way. So if the law is changed pursuant to SB 573, what it means is that if a police officer sees a pedestrian standing next to the curb, raising their arm and preparing to enter, and motorists don't stop, there is a ticket. You don't just have to have a sting. I mean, we've got a few stings that have happened in Washington and Clackamas County. And the reason we have to have stings to enforce this law is because nobody goes out and steps in front of the cars to see if they can make the car stop. Everybody's afraid to. So what this will be is easy to teach. It will be easy to enforce, and it will make it clear to motorists that, in fact, this pedestrian is wanting them to stop. There's also another part of it, and that is, the if you look in the language, you'll see that there is this language preparing to enter a crosswalk. And what it is designed to do is to make it so that the right-of-way of the pedestrian is not triggered by some kid standing on the corner motioning to his mother to come and pick him up, or putting his arm up because he wants somebody to throw him a football. It's where the person is at the crosswalk, preparing to enter the crosswalk, and raises their arm, that the legal impact is created. And so what we're trying to do is to make it a circumstance where it's clear what the person is doing. And if you go to the next page, you'll see the two photographs that, and these, you know, are intended to show applications of how SB 573 would operate. You see a skateboarder who is, it's almost like asking permission, but there's really a little bit more to it than that, because when they raise their hand and they're preparing to enter, that car must stop. And then with the baby stroller in the bottom picture, that's another nice example, because if you have somebody with a baby in a stroller, in order to trigger the old law, you had to push your baby out into the lane. Well, no mother or father wants to do that. So what this does is it makes it so that you can raise your arm and the motorists have to stop. And I might add that under the 573, this also applies to bicyclists, because bicyclists have the same rights and duties as pedestrians on sidewalks and crosswalks. And the nice thing about that is that kids who are riding their bikes to school will be able to raise that hand, get the motorists to stop before they go rolling into the crosswalk. Thank you.
And the way this is phrased, the person doesn't have to raise their hand. They could also just step out into the crosswalk. So if they forget to raise their hand or whatever, they still have the rights.
Exactly. It adds to the presently existing law.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The panel before us and I were meeting before. We actually had a dash one amendment trying to do some clarification. I understand the issues they have. Now that I'm sitting here, now that I've got the book, I want us to walk through this because I don't think the bill as it's written gets to where we want to go. I know what the intention is. Basically, if I understand from the testimony, what we want to do is have a third option for when a driver has the duty to stop and remain stopped. Under the current statute, the way it's written, you have what is in the bill, which would be lines basically 5 through line 10, and it's collapsed into one paragraph. I'm going to pass this down to the chair, because when you have that and you read it together and you take that semicolon on line 6 out, instead of setting up another subdivision with this new sub A, because the way it currently reads is you don't have a division there in the current text. So currently it reads that the driver of a vehicle commits the offense of failure to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian if the driver does not stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian when the pedestrian is, and then the colon. That's what the current law says. And then you basically have the two modifiers. One, they're following a traffic control device, so they're downtown Portland. You've got a signal telling you to stop, to cross, mm-hmm. as pursuant to 814.010. And then you see the or that's bracketed right now. The other trigger, current law, is crossing the roadway in a crosswalk as defined. And that's it. There's a semicolon, and we've now added a new or. And so what we're trying to do is pick up this preparing to enter a crosswalk. But what it does is, unfortunately, what legislative council did is once you get past at the end of line 11, you have that and, which is currently in the statute, they are taking out the next more important phrase, in any of the following locations. So basically, if you stay above line 11, you have two components of how someone violates the law, and then they say, and in any of the following locations, you are also in violation if you don't stop for a person in these situations. And the way it's now written under the bill, we're now putting modifiers on when you, quote-unquote, may be preparing to enter the crosswalk and saying you have to do one of these other things. And that's the part that I think, as much as I know everyone wants this bill to move forward and today's the day, I guess my perspective on this is we're not getting there.
Okay, what you're saying is, because that was my concern that I thought was clear in the bill, what you're saying is that you'd have to signal no matter what, even if you're at a signal?
I'm saying, Chair, when you look at the text of how the current statute's written, it basically sets two ways that two sure ways that you are violating the statute. And that is basically, if you just read the statute itself, where it starts off as if the driver of a vehicle commits the offense, it covers through what is on the bill, which is up through the end of line 10 without the or.
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying right off that you're going to commit this offense if you don't stop for someone that's crossing the street following a traffic control device, or when they're in the crosswalk, they're crossing the roadway in a crosswalk. Follow that?
Yeah, I mean, that's okay. The way the current...
Okay, and then when you look as the current statute reads, the next thing is and what's being dropped out of the bill is on line 12, is basically another set of circumstances where a driver would be in violation. That would be in any of the following locations. And what the current law provides is that in those locations, which are the A, B, C, D, mm-hmm. and E, is another means that you could be held accountable for violating the statute. But when legislative council has now taken that phrase out in any of the following locations and now says the pedestrian enters into, it really doesn't accomplish what I think we're trying to do. And that's, we're trying to go through this in the office very hastily and I just couldn't wrap my arms around what was being done. But I think once I saw that statute without any modification to it, and then see how this bill would play out and see how the ors and the ands will impact the language, I think it really shifts us away.
See, I look at this as a grammatical change, because you really don't need the phrase "in the following locations," because the colon sets up the.
So, do you need to take the "and" out on line 11 to make that the "or"? So then you have where the pedestrian is entering into these other areas, or what? Are you just saying drop the "and" at the end of line 11?
See, I think this is just legislative council cleaning up the language. I don't think this changes it, but I haven't looked at it in that light, Senator Pazansky.
Okay. Well, if the chair wants to move the bill, I will vote to get it out of committee, but I'm going to reserve the right to vote not support it on the floor until I get this clear. This just came before us 5 minutes before we were supposed to start.
No, I don't need to move the bill today. I'd rather make sure that we're clear on it, because we don't want to interfere with the original intent.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I definitely want to make sure we get this right before moving it. So I'm completely there. I have a question for Senator Pazansky. Well, I guess I don't know if I have the prerogative to do that, but
go ahead.
I guess
I got the wrong morning.
I think that you're talking about, and one of the issues that I want to put out there to either Ray or you, Senator Pazansky, which is on the current lines 8 and 9, proceeding in accordance with traffic control devices provided by ORS, there's a semicolon, and then there's no or. So my understanding is that wouldn't be modified by the or and the and below it. But then the B and the C would be modified by the lines 12 and 16. I don't think that we want lines 8 and 9 to be modified. That is standalone, and I completely agree with you there. And so I'm looking specifically to other folks and what your sense is there. My sense is that that's not modified by those, and if they are, then I do think we definitely have to go back to
I don't think by removing the or on line 9 and putting semicolon there impacts what the current statute says. My concern is when you drop down to line 11 and you're entering into a new phrase of preparing to enter a crosswalk, which isn't really defined as to what that means, and you have the word "and" that's still in there from the original. That "and" seems like you're now tying everything that would be on lines 8 through 11 to what is below that.
Mm.
That's the problem I see, is that we've now created, because see that "and" in the original statute, all it was saying is setting up another set of criteria where you could be in violation, because it says "and" in any of the following locations. That's the way I see it.
Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. I see what you're raising, I Senator Pazansky. My initial read on it is sort of in my staff measure summary. The way I read it is that under existing law, there are basically two elements. The first element can be satisfied in one of two ways: that the person, the pedestrian, is proceeding in accordance with a traffic control device is one, or is crossing a roadway in the crosswalk.
Mm-hmm.
That's element one. You can satisfy that either way.
Right.
And then the second element, and you also have to have the second element, concerns the physical location of the pedestrian. And the physical location of the pedestrian is the pedestrian must be entering or at one of five locations. And that's the lane the driver is in, a lane adjacent, et cetera. So you need both elements under existing law,
mm-hmm.
is how I read current statute.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you add what Senate Bill 573 does is on that first element, it gives you
a third option.
And
right.
The third option is you're you're proceeding in accordance with the traffic control device, you're actually crossing the roadway in the crosswalk, or you are preparing to enter a crosswalk. That's a third way to satisfy element one.
Yep.
And then you still have to satisfy this other element two to be in one of these locations. But what lines 22 and 23 do is they say, by making this hand gesture, that means you're entering the lane. And so you satisfy element two by doing one. You're actually entering the lane. So that's at least the way that I read it presently.
All right. So I can buy that. I guess the one thing that when we looked at this before was that on line 23 where it says entering into a lane, the amendment that we had drafted not being introduced or presented this time was preparing to enter a crosswalk. So, Councilman, your interpretation, we would leave the entering into the lane because then it's only modifying those five other options under number two?
Under my interpretation, yes. It possibly could be worded more cleanly, but under my interpretation as I read this, yes. The way they phrased it, entering into a lane, in effect, parallels the second element.
You know, as you discuss it, it occurs to me that you might not even need line 11 because you cover that material in line 22 and 23. In other words, it seems redundant where you make a criterion, you make a third category preparing to enter a crosswalk. So I'm not sure you need that because you define entering a crosswalk in line 22 and 23. So, Senator Przanski, if we got rid of line 11, if my interpretation is correct, we got rid of line 11 and restored the language from the previous, it restored the deleted language and then simply added line 22, I don't think we would have lost anything. Are you all following me?
We're following you, and we feel that what you say is correct, that it does not detract from it. And if it did say what you just stated, in other words, take that clause out, and then said on line 12, instead of the pedestrian enters into, the words the pedestrian is entering or is in, I think that in my universe is even what you said and better and more clear. But to go back to the original text of this, and the reason that we felt comfortable endorsing it is that while it may be that preparing to enter a crosswalk is surplusage, as the chair pointed out, we feel that what the text of SB 573 does is to add another way to get there. That was the intent, to add another way to get there. It may not have been the most artful way that we could possibly do it, but it's what LC came up with, and we felt that we could live with it because I've looked at it in terms of whether we are creating a grammatical problem, and I've walked through it, and I felt like the way that it's presently written is adequate to do that which we had sought to do. But I do agree with you, and in fact, it's kind of funny because we had talked about how, if we were going to do this ourselves, might we improve it? And when I heard you saying that, I thought, oh my goodness, because that exactly tracks some of the talk we had. But we thought about, well, whether we should suggest that it be changed to make just that change, or should we go with the way Legislative Council did it. And so we walked it through every way that we could think of, and we felt that it worked adequately the way that SB 573 is presently drafted, that there were no little sneaky tricks. And when I hear Committee Council describe it, in fact, that process that he described in terms of the grammatical and functional operation of it is indeed the same thing that we came up with in the way it worked with the new version and compared to the old law.
So you agree that the material, the changes that are made in the material from line 12 through, on down to line 16, that those changes are non-substantive, just grammatical.
Correct.
I have another concern with the material on material on line 11, and that is when you say preparing to enter a crosswalk, I wouldn't want to have any ambiguity about somebody coming up to a marked crosswalk, a signaled crosswalk, and feeling that they could just go against the wait sign by and the way this is, that a crosswalk is not defined, not redefined as ORS 801.220 in this particular line. So,
Senator Beyer first, and I've got a follow-up.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you were to get rid of line 11, you'd get me closer, a lot closer to supporting a bill, because the way I see line 11, that thing, that broadens this bill so wide that someone coming down a street 100 yards away from the street could be preparing to enter the crosswalk. Mm-hmm. If that person raises their hand, potentially the person would have to stop, and the person could still be a long distance away from the street if they're preparing to enter a crosswalk.
And that's,
and so I think you're right, and I think if you take out line 11 and do the hand signal, I think it actually improves current law considerably without broadening current law. And if that's the intent, because when I read this bill, I thought this makes it so if you see someone anywhere close to a street, you've got to stop, no matter what. And that would help.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, I'm in the same place. That's the example I used with the panel, is that right now preparing to enter a crosswalk is not defined in any way.
Right.
And that's why we had the dash one amendments, because the other alternative was on line 23 to strike entering into a lane and put in there preparing to enter a crosswalk. That way, by being at the corner and raising your hand, signaling would tell you or tell the people that you're preparing to enter the crosswalk. But clearly we can take it out and leave the language as it's presented without an amendment, and I think it will probably be much clearer and cleaner for everyone to understand and reach the intent of what everyone wants.
So you concur with taking out line 11?
I do, because right now it's not defined. That's why I suggested the dash one amendment that's not before us, because to modify it.
Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. I actually had the same thought that you had, but one suggestion or potential problem that I see with that, if there's not an additional tweak, is the way that the statute presently is. Again, there are the two elements, and if we eliminate line 11, where that preparing to enter a crosswalk, if we eliminate that, and then let's look at the testimony, the picture, this person making this gesture
has no
does not satisfy element one, unless we tweak the definition in lines 22 and 23 a little bit further. Because that person in this photograph is not proceeding in accordance with a traffic control device, and they're not actually crossing the roadway in a crosswalk. So what 22 and 23 says is, by doing that, they're entering a lane. That's the second element,
right?
But not the first.
Okay.
So it would need to say, pedestrian raising a hand and arm toward oncoming traffic is considered to be
entering,
crossing the roadway in a crosswalk, and entering a lane. Or we could tie it more specifically to the statutory references.
Yeah, actually, this would need a reference for the purpose of the section, a pedestrian raising a hand and arm toward oncoming traffic at a crosswalk as defined in ORS 801.220 is considered to be entering a lane.
If you, Madam,
yes.
And when you're done, I guess I would just argue that there are probably hundreds of people who've gotten tickets right outside this building in these stings, that the person was doing this, standing on the edge of the roadway, not in the street, not with an arm raised, under current law, ticketed.
Mm-hmm. The person got ticketed.
The person got ticketed. If they were standing at the edge of a crosswalk, still on the sidewalk, the state police and the Salem City Police, right outside this building, were giving tickets for people.
Drivers?
To drivers. To people standing on the sidewalk, but at the crosswalk. So for maybe people need to know that they were not breaking the law when they went by them under current law, because the police today are issuing tickets for people standing next to crosswalks.
The stings that I've seen have all required, and that's why they do it as a sting, they've required that the pedestrian actually make that move into entering the crosswalk. And when Senator Prezansky told us about this concern that he had, I checked to see if preparing to enter a crosswalk was defined anywhere, and he's 100% right. It's not. It's not defined. So these, while I'm, you know, we said we could live with it the way it is, these suggestions that you've made seem to be good ones. And
well, and this brings up another issue too, because, you know, I can see what there are two things. There's a sting where you have a decoy that goes out there, and they're going to do it exactly as the law said. They're going to be in the crosswalk. But out here, they're doing it with live people, I think, real people.
Yeah, they're watching people come up to the sidewalk.
They're interpreting it. So in the scenario that you have outside this building, if a pedestrian is not in the crosswalk but they want to cross the street, then in addition to providing them a mechanism for stopping the traffic, it also provides them with an affirmative duty if they're not in the crosswalk. So from a from the car driver's standpoint,
absolutely,
that would give the car driver more clarity.
Like right. I said, if you get rid of line 11, if you get rid of that phrase preparing to enter a crosswalk, I think you've improved current law. But if you keep that in there, you've broadened it.
I think counsel's point on the line 22-23 by clarifying that as to that motion, meaning that you're entering into a lane or the crosswalk, will make it clear, and that should serve everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I don't know if you have to have a, like, if someone was back at the coffee shop standing under the awning and didn't want to get rained on and didn't want to step out right by the crosswalk, I don't think the traffic is obligated to scan the horizon. So I just wonder if we should have, you know, a pedestrian raising a hand and an arm toward oncoming traffic within, you know, a pedestrian within 3 feet of the lane or 2 feet of the lane or some quantifiable thing so that somebody can't, you know, just stand too far away and then try to invoke their rights.
Yeah. The only thing, Madam Chair, when we start looking at those type of distances, it becomes arbitrary. I understand where the Chair wants to go, and if you want that, I mean, we could try it, but it may set up more of an issue. I mean, the one thing that we're doing, we're distinguishing ourselves away from what I call the California rule, where if someone is standing on the curb at the crosswalk, the duty is imposed right then. And here we're actually requiring that affirmative action.
Well, and I think if you said something like at the crosswalk, or you know, if you said something like that, you might get around that problem.
Madam Chair, I think that would be helpful. I mean, if you get rid of preparing to enter a crosswalk, when I saw that, my first thing that came to my mind was a bicycle rider, you know, 50 feet from the edge of the street, holding up his hand.
Riding hard,
and, you know, you're supposed to do that. So if you don't have that in, but it would be helpful if you, even more helpful, I guess, more clear if you wanted to put in some language so the drivers don't have to be looking down the streets looking for someone with a hand held up.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I really liked your examples of, you know, the fact that we use hand signals in other settings. I mean, I've come from a time when we used to use hand signals in cars. They didn't mean how old I am. And, of course, on bicycles.
We're not talking about those kind of hands. It's different.
Excuse me, Senator Beyer.
There's laws against that.
Yeah, there's some hand signals that are still in use today. Okay, well, do we have clarity on what we are talking about here? And Senator Prezansky, would you be willing to lend a hand on?
I am in council, probably clarifying. Between the two of us and with the panel.
That'd be wonderful.
If we're successful, there will be fewer needs for those types of hand signals and salutes between pedestrians and motorists.
Yeah, I don't see anything about salutes in here.
Right.
Did you want to say anything further?
I'm thankful I'm not a legislator.
No, actually, I'm
Could
Dr.
you identify yourself for
yeah,
the
I'm report? Dr. Zalata from Portland. I have a small clinic on Fremont Street, and I'm not here as a representative of the OPAC committee, but just as an individual. And One of the issues that I heard about on the committee is crossing large highways with crosswalks and compliance, particularly in like Lincoln City and Newport, mm-hmm. where people, even though they have the authorization to go across, they don't have anything ostensible to slow down traffic. And as roadways separate schools from where people live, that becomes a greater safety issue. On my own small business, small clinic, on a very busy street, we have the same issues where people are actually hidden by large SUVs and people can't even see them unless they really motion with a hand. So I think the elegance of this is really that it's a visible sign mm-hmm. to say, I need passage.
Yeah, one of the places I notice this is Martin Luther King outside the convention center. There's a lot of parking up there, and you can't. It's a legal crosswalk. They probably should paint it. They certainly should paint it to make it very clear to everyone, but it's impossible to get traffic to even slow down in that location.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions of this panel or comments? Senator Walker, you're being awfully quiet over there.
I am, Madam Chair. I'm hanging on by a thread here with my sickness. And you seem to have a great handle on this bicycle safety issue.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I hope you feel better. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll
bring this one back. Okay. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 573. Switch councils. And thank you. You all clear on
take a name and run, huh?
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2357A. Council, you can get your wits about you before you start here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2357A concerns electronic filing of documents in the Oregon court system. It permits the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to adopt rules allowing the use of electronic documents for all documents that are served or filed in any legal action in Oregon. Establishes that the Chief Justice may promulgate rules for the electronic service of a document other than service of a summons or initial complaint or petition. The bill permits the state court administrator to establish procedures for the destruction of records and other documents after making electronic or other copies of the documents. It requires trial court administrators to seal and store an original or negative copy of a document and ensure that any electronic copies of documents are updated into commonly used formats. The bill substitutes or adds the word document into various statutes that use the term paper or process.
Okay, we have signed up Mark Comstock from the Oregon State Bar and Kingsley Click from the courts.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Mark Comstock. I practice law here in Salem. Until December 31st, I was a member of the Board of Governors of the State Bar. One of my duties as a governor, I was put in charge of a task force to study the feasibility of electronic filing of pleadings and documents in state courts. Currently, the federal courts, both federal district court and the federal bankruptcy court, do allow and require electronic filing of pleadings, and their record is an electronic record. And that is what the task force studied and issued its report. Unfortunately, I ran off from my office and didn't bring enough copies. I will say that copies of the task force report is on the State Bar website, and I certainly can rustle up some copies and get them here to you. What the Bar's task force identified was
modern courts are in fact using electronic filing and electronic record as a way of solving many of the inefficiencies that exist, because we are still using technology that is essentially 150 years old, and that is a piece of paper in a file jacket to be how you track the documents in the file. So what the task force identified was the authority that the Chief Justice had under the statutes was not broad enough to address the potential of going to an electronic filing system in a couple of ways. First, it was still tied to a paper document being filed. And second, it didn't identify that the Chief Justice could establish by rules a method to have electronic filing and electronic service of documents as the federal court does. So what the task force and the Judicial Department have done, have put together this bill, HB 2357, in its A form, to address the need for broader language, and also to identify how the electronic record assures that it is a true copy of either a paper record or an electronic document that was filed. So I certainly could go through the document, but if you had questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
I just would, you know, obviously accuracy is of the essence on this, and I just, you know, what kind of safeguards do you see for making sure that it really is a true copy?
Well, the bill, as it is in existence, page 3, section 2, requires that the State Court Administrator's Office develop the procedures to provide that before any records are destroyed, that there is a true and accurate copy, whether it's by technology such as microfishing or actual creation of an electronic record, similar to the public document format that is used in the federal courts. So before a hard copy is destroyed, there would have to be certification of the method of keeping that and the method of accessing it. What this bill anticipates is there may be situations where an electronic record, let's say a microfiche, is created, and 10 years down the road, we have a new technology and microfiche machines are hard to come by, and the electronic record would be transformed into the newer technology, and the certification process would go forward that way to make sure that the current record is the one that is true to the document. So that's giving the Office of the State Court Administrator the authority to establish and deal with technology as it goes along and make sure that we're keeping up with technology.
A lot of what we do around here these days is trying to keep up with technology. Thank you. Are there any questions, Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've got no problem if you're trying to store records digitally. I think that's great. I think the council said it at the start. I just want to make sure I hear somebody, one of you guys say it, that as long as somebody can't go to jail by email, and, I mean, there's still got to be paper when you're talking to, putting people away for life or incarcerating people, they still got to have an ability to see it on paper.
Chairman Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer. That is, if I can address what you're talking about there, this bill specifically provides that if there is an electronically filed pleading to initiate an action, that the pleading and a summons must still be served in the manner that it is now. It's not served by electronic form. It would be served by a process server coming out and finding you and saying, here's the document. It does still require that the initial jurisdictional document that brings someone into court is still physically delivered.
And that can't be changed by rule by the court, state court administrator.
This specifically provides that excluded from the breadth of the rules is a rule that would allow for service of summons and complaint as summons and initial complaint or petition. So that's on page 2, lines 21 and 22, and that was the specific subject of the amendment over on the House side.
Thank you.
No, you chat.
Thank you. I guess I won't introduce my amendment to send Senator Beyer to prison by email.
E-jail. E-filings.
We'll send you to e-jail. Okay, that was a good question, Senator Beyer. Thank you for putting that on the record. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Comstock knows that we're in bankruptcy court, and we've had this system for a while. But I'll tell you who gets the short end of the stick here, and it's the court reporter. So I'm going to address this question to Ms. Click. We have to file, as the court reporter, we have to file all of our transcripts now electronically, like attorneys file all their documents. But once our transcript's filed electronically and it's up there for God and everybody to see and download, they then don't come to me anymore to order the transcript and pay me the fee that I'm rightfully owed or any other court reporter in Oregon. I fought with the bankruptcy court on this issue. We've never resolved it. And so I'm saying to you that it needs to be resolved if you're going to implement this system at the state level. People should not be able to get this for free. It is the work product of a court reporter. You can't just say, well, I don't want to order the transcript because I know the court reporter has to file it. And then once it's filed and up on the web, they just download it. And the court reporter does not get paid for their work product. So I have concerns about that, and I want a commitment that you're going to be working with the Court Reporters Association on how to address those issues, Ms. Click.
Licensing fees and royalties.
Ms. Click, would you like to introduce yourself for the record and say what you wanted to say and also address Senator Walker's comment?
Thank you. For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. My main purpose in being here was to show support for the bill that the Board of Bar Governors brought forward. We had members on the task force, Doug Bray, Trial Court Administrator Multnomah, and other representatives, and they've worked closely with our IT initiatives going forward in trying to identify procedural barriers to implementing a more robust electronic system to respond to businesses, bar members, the public, and access. To Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, to your question, I don't know that I read in the task force report anything specific to that subject that would, and I'm not familiar with what the bankruptcy court is doing in that regard. Senator Burdick, Senator Walker, all I say is we would look at that. As you know, the majority of the recordings and reportings are in an electronic form right now, with some exceptions. So that would also have to be taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Whoever provides that, Madam Chair, if I could follow up. I don't know how your system works with the way you folks do it without live reporters, but a transcript has to be produced. And generally, when we produce a transcript, we make money by selling copies of the work product. And so I just want to make sure, for instance, the Oregon State Bar and the Court Reporters Association have rules promulgated that attorneys know they have to come to the court reporter to get copies of the transcript, and they can't copy it from some other counsel who paid for it, and then they don't pay for it. Now, I know that sometimes that isn't always followed, but for the most part, it is. And I just want people to be aware of that, that it is someone's work product and they have to pay for it.
Thank you. But this bill doesn't specifically apply to that situation.
Yes, it requires all filings to be electronically, and it requires the Chief Justice on page 2, line 31, rules adopted by the Chief Justice. So my anticipation is that they will require court reporters to file their transcripts electronically.
You said you already were, so that's where I was getting confused.
Yeah,
there.
Well, we do in the federal court.
In the federal court.
And so the Chief Justice is going to be adopting, promulgating these rules, and I'm just letting them know, I'm firing the shot out there right now, but that's one of the things I want looked at in the rule.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2357A.
I'm okay as long as they...
Oh, no, you got that on the record. We will open a work session on House Bill 2357A. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2357A engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2357A engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
Only, Madam Chair, that I put my concerns on the record because I support this kind of thing. This is really a great way to make courts more efficient, and it's worked well in the bankruptcy court system, but I'm going to be watching.
Okay. No objection. So ordered. Senator Walker, I think we'll let you carry this one.
Okay. And that way I can put that on the floor, too. Thank you.
Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2384. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2384 clarifies that an insurer's liability to a policyholder who was an occupant of a motor vehicle is presumed not to exceed the liability limits of the insurance available to that policyholder.
Okay. We have signed up Wendy Johnson.
Chair Burdick, members Welcome. Of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Before you is House Bill 2384. It comes to you with the recommendation of the Oregon Law Commission. I think I can safely say it's the easiest bill from the Law Commission this session. It adds three words. You have to look quite a long time just to figure out what the bill, where the change is. It's on page 5, line 39 to the bill. To a statute that's a model insurance policy for uninsured motorist coverage. Last session, the Law Commission had 4 auto insurance bills, and one of them was to clarify the priority with primary and excess in uninsured motorist coverage policies, and 3 words were mistakenly omitted, and so we're coming back this session with this bill just to add those 3 words that were mistakenly taken out.
Has any damage arisen from the omission for that 2-year period?
My understanding is that this is a model policy, and so policies were in existence already, and folks recognized that it was a mistake, and so it hasn't caused any damage yet, but we need to get it fixed.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, close the hearing on
Madam Chair,
Senator Beyer.
The bill doesn't have an emergency clause, so it's going to, if you don't emergency clause, it won't go into effect until January 1st of next year. So is that something that
What are your thoughts on that, Wendy?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, we generally don't put emergency clauses on our bills just because of costs and et cetera, but, you know, we'd be amenable to an emergency clause. But I don't think it was a strong feeling that it was that broken of a problem.
Well, it is a model statute, and if people are in the business are aware of the issue, I'll leave it to you, Senator Beyer. If you'd like to put one on, we can certainly do that.
I could also add it on the House.
It's already passed the House.
Oh, this is already through.
This is the last stop.
It's the last chance. Sorry.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, it's another 8 months to create a problem that you could avoid by taking a 5-minute emergency clause.
Let's order up an emergency clause. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2385. Thank you.
The actual word.
The monkeys. The song by the monkeys.
Okay, I guess.
Last train to Clarksville.
Can't.
Last train to Clarksville. Okay. Changing council again. Three council day here.
That's right.
We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2359.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2359 comes to you at the request of the House Interim Judiciary Committee for the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Section. The bill clarifies a preference for surviving spouses to bank account of his or her deceased spouse when the account is less than $25,000. Applies to deposit or a person whose death occurs on or after the effective date of the 2007 Act.
Okay. Ryan Gibb. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Gibb. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. Primary focus of my practice is elder law, dealing with probate, estate planning, and other types of areas of law. Part of that practice involves probate, which can be handled in a number of different ways. If an individual passes away and they have assets that don't have a joint owner or beneficiary designation on them, they're not owned in a trust, those assets must be passed on in some way. Typically, they are handled through either a full probate, which is a 6 to 12-month process through the court, or if they're within the guidelines, they're handled in a small estate proceeding, which is an expedited type of a proceeding. However, if the asset which needs to be transferred is a deposit account at a financial institution, that account is $25,000 or less, the banking statutes allow for what's called an affidavit of heirship. The heir or creditor can file the affidavit with the bank, and the bank has the authority through the statute to transfer that deposit account to the heirs or the creditor without the need for any court proceeding. There have been occasions in recent history where the financial institutions have hesitated to transfer the funds in a deposit account to a surviving spouse because of the possibility of a Medicaid recovery by the estate administration unit of DHS. The rules of DHS recovery are that they will not recover any funds if there is a surviving spouse or if there is a disabled child or a minor child. Nevertheless, there are a number of banking institutions who have denied the surviving spouse the opportunity to recover these funds from the account until DHS has had a chance to file its claim. And once they have failed to file such a claim, then they will provide those funds to the surviving spouse. The purpose of House Bill 2359 is to clarify the timelines that different groups of individuals have in order to file that affidavit of heirship with the banking institution. Specifically, we wanted to make clear that a surviving spouse can immediately go to the bank, file an affidavit of heirship, and recover those funds without the bank requiring any kind of a waiting period for the Department of Human Services to file their affidavit. The language in House Bill 2359 clarifies that the surviving spouse can, or the bank or financial institution on demand of the surviving spouse can receive the funds that were owned by the deceased depositor. The intent of the bill is not to limit the ability of the surviving spouse only to recover those funds within the first 45 days, but rather to clarify that for the first 45 days, it's only the surviving spouse who can step in and recover these funds. After that 45-day period, the Department of Human Services can step in and recover those funds. And after the Department of Human Services has had their opportunity, if they have not filed such an affidavit, then other heirs may step in and file such an affidavit. So the purpose is not to limit the surviving spouse only to 45 days, but rather to clarify that within that first 45 days, it's the spouse who gets the first chance to recover those funds. There's no loss to the estate administration unit, the DHS, because those are not funds that they would attempt to recover anyway because of their policy not to recover if there is a surviving spouse. The bill is fairly simple, and that's really the intent of it. There are several sections dealing with several different types of banking institutions as set out in the statutes. The elder law section has proposed this, and we urge the committee to move it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
You're saying, I guess it was a little confusing, you say DHS doesn't recover funds like this where there's a surviving spouse, so substantively wouldn't change anything in that regard. It would just make the banks free it up more readily.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
But then you said after the first 45 days, DHS would have a claim on it if the surviving spouse hadn't gone in within 45 days. But why would that be relevant if they don't do it anyway?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the purpose is to make sure that within the first 45 days, only the surviving spouse would have that opportunity. If there is no, after that 45-day period, if there is no surviving spouse or anybody else with a priority claim above DHS, then DHS can step in and file their claim.
So after 45 days, DHS just assumes there's no surviving spouse?
Madam Chair, that's what we assume, yes.
Okay. Do you know if this policy of DHS is not to reclaim the funds when there is a surviving spouse? Do you know if that's by statute or by rule?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is within the Oregon Administrative Rules, the estate recovery provisions within the OARs.
And then is the recovery made when the surviving spouse passes away?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the DHS will only recover if the they will only recover from what is available, from what has the Medicaid recipient's name on it when the Medicaid recipient passes away. They will not follow that through generally to the estate of the surviving spouse, although there is an argument that they would have the right to do that. I've not seen them do that in my practice. However, I have had them inquire as to whether or not, when the surviving spouse has passed away and we're doing the surviving spouse's probate, I have had DHS inquire of me whether or not there were any assets that the surviving spouse received at the death of the Medicaid recipient because of a statute.
Okay, and I guess by definition this wouldn't be a problem with very wealthy people avoiding the Medicaid recovery because they wouldn't have qualified in the first place if their spouse had a lot of resources. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. Not very many people that I've seen who have very much money qualify for Medicaid. And in these situations, this is not a case where, again, where Medicaid or DHS would be recovering anyway within this first 45-day period. So this isn't something that's going to be used to shelter assets or shield them from Medicaid recovery. Rather, it's just ensuring that if the surviving spouse, if there is a surviving spouse, that they would have the ability to go in and get those funds out of the deposit account without having to wait for a claim that DHS isn't going to make anyway. The fairly typical situation would be husband is on Medicaid, he passes away, there may be a bank account that just had his name on it. The wife may not have a lot of money in her name or in a joint checking account, needs to access his account in order to pay for funeral expenses, in order to pay for her own living expenses. This allows her to go to the banking institution, recover those funds, and cover those bills as they arise. And again, it's a situation where DHS would not be stepping in to recover anyway.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2359. Open a work session on House Bill 2359. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2359 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2359 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Anybody like to carry this? Senator Pazanski volunteered. Okay. Last bill, open a public hearing on House Bill 2361.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2361 comes here at the request of the House Interim Committee on the Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar of State Planning Section. Clarifies that for the purpose of determining the distribution of an entity constitutes distribution of principal income, the determination is based on whether the entity distributes more than 20% of its assets, not whether the trust receives more than 20% of the assets distributed.
Okay. Jeffrey M. Chain and Samuels Kenter. Maybe. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Sheen. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar, have been since 1990, and I'm also a member of the Samuels, Yolen, Cantor, Seymour, Spinrad law firm in Portland. This is our 80th year of being a law firm.
I apologize for not picking that up. I thought I knew all of them. Thank you.
Okay. I am licensed to practice in Oregon, California, and Washington, and I'm here as an advisory member to the Executive Committee of the Oregon State Bar's Estate Planning and Administration section. Our section is composed of more than 1,000 attorneys in the state of Oregon who assist clients in estate planning, probate, and trust administration. I have provided you with some testimony. It's a little bit technical. This bill, HB 2361, is a technical correction to ORS 129-300-4, subparen B. Basically, under the general concept of the Oregon Uniform Principal and Income Act, is it's a directive to trustees on how to treat expenses and distributions. By analogy, it tells the trustees that if an income comes in, you put it in the income bucket. If it's directed or defined to be income, it goes in the principal bucket. If it's from an activity that's regarded as principal. The problem that occurred here is in the area of liquidating distributions coming out of a business entity. The statute as it currently stands says that unless the trustee knows that that's a liquidating distribution, under Oregon law, they would be required to put that in the income bucket. The reason why that potentially can cause problems is oftentimes we have trusts where the income beneficiaries are different than the principal beneficiaries. The drafters of the statute, when they originally created it, intended for these types of distributions to be treated as principal. So what we're going back to, and what the statute did, is looked at, is the what was received by the trustee more than 20% of the assets involved in a liquidation? So what we're doing with this provision is to say, change your focus, trustee, and look at what the company distributes. If they're distributing more than 20% of their gross assets as part of their distribution, then trustee, you treat that as principal and not as income. Now, the California case that's referenced in your material, Thomas versus Elder, reached a contrary conclusion and said, no, treat it as income. And the reason they reached that conclusion was that the focus of the California statute, which was exactly like Oregon's is now, was to measure that 20% trust on what the trustee actually received. So what we're doing with this corrective legislation is change the focus from what you receive over to what was actually distributed and look at the big picture. I'm not aware of any opposition to this bill, and certainly am here to request that it be forwarded on with a due pass recommendation. And I know your time is valuable, so I will conclude at that point.
Well, you clearly understand this area of the law. And you may be the only one in the room who does. So I appreciate you coming today. Are there questions from the committee? No one dares. Okay.
We know better.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2361, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2361. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2361 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2361 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Does anybody want to carry this?
Cruz bus.
What?
Cruz, we can give it to Cruz.
He's not here.
I actually did okay in Trust in the States if you want me to take
it. You actually did, Senator Prezansky?
Got a book for my endeavors on that.
Okay, Senator Prezansky has very kindly volunteered to carry this bill.
Going up the hill for the committee.
Right. Okay, well, I've already discussed this with Senator Beyer, so just a reminder for the committee, a couple schedule changes. On Monday, we will be meeting both in the afternoon and in the evening, starting at 5 o'clock on the anti-discrimination legislation, Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 500. And on March 16th, we will be meeting, have an out-of-town meeting at Lewis and Clark Law School on Senate Bill 571, the Clean Indoor Air Act. We will have a work session on that bill that day. And we will have on our agenda for hearing several bills relating to animals. As you probably know, the Lewis and Clark Law School has an animal law section. So we will be focusing on those bills.
The two bills on Monday, which one? There you said two and Senate Bill 2 and which one?
Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 500.
Okay.
Senate Bill 2 will be our vehicle for eventually addressing this issue.
They deal with the same issue.
Yes, they deal with the same issue.
And we're still meeting in this room?
We will meet in this room. Very good question, Senator Walker. We will meet in this room, at least at this point. We're planning to meet in this room at 1 o'clock, mm-hmm. and then we'll move downstairs into one of the A, B, or C rooms for the 5 o'clock portion of it.
Okay. Where
I expect we'll get some public participation. Okay, we are adjourned.
But not as much as we have for landings.
Yeah, no.